It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Members of the United Auto Workers are voting on new contracts with Detroit's big three auto manufacturers. The agreements would cap off a weeks-long campaign of targeted strikes. Now, the UAW and the three unionized car companies have tentative agreements on things like wage increases, a boost in retirement benefits, and where and how some products are made. UAW President Sean Fain addressed union members yesterday during a Facebook Live video presentation highlighting the gains and the aggressive walkout strategy.
This strategy was only possible because of you, the membership. You had faith and you were unified. Not every union can go to the bargaining table and say, our members are ready to walk out with zero notice, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's how powerful our solidarity is in the UAW. We started from a 9% wage offer and ended at 25%. We didn't take the first offer. We didn't take the second offer. Across the three companies, we had over 30 contracts offered.
We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Were you, your family, or friends affected in some way by the UAW strikes and now by this tentative agreement? What kind of impact does this have on you? If you've been following this story, maybe as an auto consumer, do you have thoughts or questions about how this all shook out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Micheline Maynard is a journalist and broadcaster based in Michigan. She's the author of the 2003 book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. 20 years later, she recently launched a Substack newsletter as a kind of digital sequel to the book. It's called Intersection, Everything That Moves. Mickey, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be back with you. Thanks.
Let's start with what's going on right now. What are we seeing as various locals vote to ratify or not these agreements?
Well, a number of locals have ratified them. And let's remember that Ford, Chrysler, although they're called Stellantis now, and General Motors are all voting sort of consecutively because the deals were reached first at Ford, second at Stellantis, and then at General Motors. So you're seeing big locals across the country vote on the contract, and the results will probably be in a week or so.
Can you compare the expectations that UAW President Sean Fain had set at the outset when these walkouts started with what we're seeing in the actual tentative agreements?
So a little background on Sean Fain. He was elected in March as UAW president, the first time a UAW president has been directly elected. The president used to be elected by leadership of the union, and this is a real groundbreaking person for the union. No one has ever been directly elected before, and immediately during his campaign and then as president, he started talking about getting back what the union has lost in concessions over the last 15 or 20 years. He was talking about a 40% wage increase over 5 years. He was talking about restoration of cost of living allowances, which are called COLA. He was talking about gains for retirees who had really not gotten much of anything out of UAW contracts over the last decades, I would say. And he was also talking about something called tiers. In 2007, the UAW agreed to concessions with the car companies that allowed new workers to be hired in at sharply lower wages and less generous benefits. In 2007, let's remember, car companies were closing plants. And indeed, I think Janesville closed in 2009. So hiring was not really an issue back in the zero zeros. It was keeping your plant open. Well, fast forward, and a number of plants have hired people, and you now have kind of a division in the union of about 60% of workers who were hired before 2007 and 40% who've hired since 2007. So you might be working, you might have two people working alongside each other, one making $32 an hour and one making $16 or $17 an hour.
One other wider ongoing issue here is the car market is changing slowly, but maybe picking up steam to more electric vehicle production. That's been a concern. How those are made, how and who makes the batteries, and whether those are made by UAW employees. How did that factor into all this?
So Sean Fain talked a lot during these negotiations about a just transition, because everybody in the auto industry knows that electric vehicles are about to become more important. And this isn't just an American issue. This is a global issue. Electric vehicles are huge in China, and European countries are mandating the end to internal combustion engines over the next 15 or so years. So the American companies are really pushing to develop electric vehicles, and in particular electric vehicle batteries. And each of the car companies has a joint venture with a South Korean company or a Japanese company to build electric vehicle batteries. Now they're planning to build significantly big plants in the United States to produce those batteries. But what the UAW wanted was a guarantee that those employees would be represented by the union.
Talking to Micheline Maynard, journalist and broadcaster based in Michigan, looking at the UAW auto strike, the tentative deals reached now with the big three automakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe personal experiences if you were involved in this, 800-642-1234. So Micheline, what was the resolution that came out of these agreements when it came to electric vehicles? I think one of your recent pieces on Substack said they got some of it. There's still some open questions.
Yeah. So here's a little bit of a complexity. If it's a car, if it's a plant that's owned by one of the big three automakers, they can require that those workers be UAW members. But in these joint venture plants, you can't require that another employer, especially an employer outside the United States, hire UAW members. So the compromise was that the plants that will be owned by the big three, the Detroit companies, will have UAW representation, and the plants that are in the joint ventures are going to have to be negotiated at some point in the future. What's very interesting is that Stellantis is going to reopen a factory in Belvidere, Illinois, not too far from Wisconsin. And people who lost their jobs there when the plant shut down this last spring will have the right of return. They can come back to the plant from wherever they've gone. And there'll be a similar situation in Lordstown, Ohio, near Youngstown, where there is an electric battery venture that's being built, and the people who are laid off from Lordstown will have the right of return if they want to go to this electric vehicle venture, and they will be able to be UAW members and get their full pay and benefits.
A certain amount of time ago, some decades ago, if we were talking about the big three in the UAW, well, we'd be talking about most of the U.S. automotive industry. Well, now we've got lots and lots of non-unionized plants in less union-friendly states around the country. It seems like in these negotiations, people on both sides were kind of looking over their shoulders at these competitive plants around the country. How big a factor is that when we see these union negotiations?
It was a big factor in these negotiations because roughly half of the U.S. market is now owned by these international brands, the transplants like Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and BMW and Mercedes-Benz. And so the UAW has never been able to organize any of those factories. They've organized, they represented workers in joint venture plants, but they don't represent workers in any of these new factories. And Sean Fain has said repeatedly that we weren't just negotiating for ourselves. We were negotiating to make these, to make our efforts at organizing these plants easier, because if you could see what the UAW members are getting, you know, you might say, oh, I'd be willing to sign a card for UAW representation. Well, literally the ink was not dry before Toyota announced that it was giving raises to employees at its plant in Georgetown, Kentucky. And so the UAW seized on that and said, see, you know, they're afraid of us coming to negotiate, but, you know, we consider people at these car makers to be our future union brothers and sisters. And they have said that they've gotten, I'm not sure if this is true, but that they've gotten thousands of inquiries so far from employees at the transplants who would like to join the union.
We're talking to journalist Micheline Maynard about the results of the UAW strikes, what's next in the auto industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? If you are a car owner or a car shopper, are you looking at electric vehicles as an option? That's a factor in these negotiations, as we just heard. Were you or your family, your community affected by plant closures over the years, including in Janesville? Are you just across the border in Illinois watching what's going to happen at that Belvedere plant that we were just talking about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Journalist Micheline Maynard is with us. Her new Substack newsletter is called Intersection, Everything That Moves. She's been covering the auto industry for a good long time now. We're talking about what the UAW strikes accomplished, where the auto industry goes next, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in the auto industry? Do you work in it now? Do you receive a pension? Have you been watching these negotiations maybe with that in mind? A lot of union action this year, a lot of resolutions, at least partly in favor of the unions. Are you glad to see that, or does that worry you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Micheline, we've seen that Actors Guild, now the Screen Actors Guild, resolve their strike. We've seen a lot of labor action this year. People have talked about the hot labor summer. Do you see the UAW tentative agreements here as part of a wider union trend in the United States?
The UAW got enormous support from other unions, from townspeople, from local businesses like bakeries and even franchise restaurants during the strike. And I really think it touched a chord. It was a great story because here you have this brand new president of the union who's basically said, you know what, no more labor management cooperations. And he said yesterday, I think, we are not the HR department for the companies. You know, we are a union. They made it very clear that this whole 40 years of labor management cooperation is over in the auto industry. You know, no more golf tournaments, no more black tie events, that kind of thing. And I think they really touched a chord with a lot of people. The economy has been awful for many people, and especially for the younger members of the union. You know, they're only getting paid about $14 to $17 an hour, depending on where they're working in the companies. And, you know, over the last couple of years, the fast food restaurant workers were able to demand more money from fast food places like McDonald's and Burger King and others. And I think the UAW members said, you know, we need to get our fair share. And Sean Fain really played off of that. And I think he got lots of sympathy for it.
The automakers argued through this process that, hey, if we give the unions everything they want or most of what they want, car prices are going to go up for consumers. We're going to be at a competitive disadvantage with those other auto plants around the country that are not unionized. Sean Fain argued that, no, we're just going to cut into some of your big profits here. What do you make of that part of the dispute?
Well, two of the companies during the negotiations said that what the union was asking for would bankrupt them, which is silly because they actually did go bankrupt in two of them in 2009, General Motors and Chrysler. At the time was Chrysler, and they were in horrible shape compared with where they are now. The other thing to think about is now 80% of vehicle sales are pickups and SUVs, and the average price of a new vehicle is now around $48,000. And when I bought my first little Toyota back in the 80s, I paid $5,200, you know, so it's unfathomable to a lot of us on how expensive vehicles have gotten. Those are probably prices that our parents and grandparents paid for a house way back when. So I think the public will probably see the car makers raise prices, but you know, when cars don't sell, rebates and incentives come right back. So this will be very interesting to see whether they can sustain higher prices or whether they're going to have to bring them down.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in New Berlin. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yes, your guest mentioned that in the joint ventures for the battery plants, that union recognition might be discussed down the road. And I was wondering if you meant a card check agreement. Was a card check agreement negotiated in the UAW contract?
So the way it's set up is in a couple of the plants, the workers have a right to flow in. In other words, they if they're part of the company and they want to go work in an electric battery plant, they go in and they remain UAW workers. And then if that fills up over 50% of the plant, then the plant becomes a UAW represented plant. And if it doesn't, then they would have a card check. And Sean Fain said specifically at two of the plants that there would be card checks. And that, so to explain what that is to listeners, you sign a card designating that the UAW is your bargaining representative. And then the National Labor Relations Board will oversee an election and they will check the cards.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Micheline, we've seen a lot of states adopt what they call right-to-work laws, making it easier for workers to opt out of paying union dues at unionized plants. How big an issue is that in a negotiation like this? Did that get in the way, or are enough of these plants in not those kind of states where it didn't matter so much?
Well, some of them are in right-to-work states, and so what right-to-work work means is that you're not forced to join a union even if one is formed in your workplace and you can't be required to pay union dues. And so that is a tricky situation, and that is part of the situation with these electric vehicle battery plants. There's going to be some in Tennessee and Kentucky, which are right-to-work states, and there is supposed to be one in Marshall, Michigan that Ford is building. General Motors is building a plant near Spring Hill, Tennessee, which people might remember from Saturn, except it's now a General Motors plant. And then the battery plant that's being built for Stellantis is outside of Belvedere. So I don't think Illinois is right to work. So that one would be a safe situation pretty much for the union. But the ones in the South are not going to be, free throws for them. They're going to have to probably do some work to organize at least one or two of them.
I want to spend a little time on electric vehicles, EVs, and their future, because this was such a big part of the story we're talking about.
Yes.
Now, we've seen a boom. It seemed like for a while the numbers escalating rapidly, but now I keep seeing articles like, well, wait a minute, Americans are getting a little shy about buying EVs. What do you see in progress toward transitioning over to electric vehicles?
So we have seen quite a lot of growth in EV purchases compared with nothing. I mean, if you think about it, EVs have been sort of curiosities over the last 20 years or so. But when Tesla came along and introduced lower priced EVs, that's when the sales have taken off. And there are a couple of models from the Detroit companies that do pretty well. We haven't seen Toyota really push into the market yet. And I think that will make a big difference. But right now, I think there's some incentives on Teslas to get people to buy them. And there's a lot of skepticism. I mean, I was looking at the map of where EV chargers are. And of course, I'm looking at the state of Michigan since I live here. But when you get north of Traverse City, there's almost no chargers up there. I mean, they're up in around Traverse City because you're vacationers. But if you have a camp up in the Upper Peninsula and you want to drive from the Detroit area to the UP, you better charge up your vehicle and make sure that you can get to where you're going and get back from where you're going, at least in time to get to a charger. And I would imagine Wisconsin is very similar, that in the North Country, there are not as many chargers as there would be around Milwaukee and Madison.
One line I've been very curious about, the electric equivalent of the Ford F-150, this incredibly popular pickup truck for home use, for job sites and more. Are people embracing that as an EV?
I think people are very intrigued by the Lightning, and I think it got off to a pretty strong start, and then there were some defects on the vehicle that gave people a little pause about it. But, the cool thing about the Lightning, to me at least, is that you can charge things from the Lightning. So if you're on a job site and you need to charge up your power tools or whatever, you can plug it into the truck and the truck will charge it up. And so that is an advantage, I think, for a lot of people who use electric vehicles for commercial uses. Again, I think the issue is, will you have the charge to get to and from where you need to get? And that's the big question about all these vehicles.
we see trend pieces about younger people, Gen Z, millennials, at least anecdotally, maybe not as interested in driving or not as interested in owning cars. Maybe they just can't afford them. I don't know. Oh, is that something that people on labor and industry side are watching and worrying about?
Definitely. I've been watching this issue for about 15 years because we've had the rise of Zipcar. We've had the rise of Lyft and Uber. Many, many cities have rental bikes, rental scooters. A lot of people are living in walkable communities. I live in a walkable community. I like the idea of not having to drive everywhere all the time. And younger people, of course, they're laden with student loan debt. Houses are expensive, living is expensive. And, you know, I think eventually if you have family, you probably will have to get a vehicle at some point, at least one vehicle for the family. But people who are, you know, 45 and younger have all these choices that didn't exist even 10 or 15 years ago. And so they aren't in a super rush to buy vehicles. Of course, I don't want to generalize because there are plenty of younger people buying vehicles, but they have choices that their mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles didn't have.
A quick question from a listener. Don't have time to take a call, but a listener wondering about plug-in hybrids. Are we seeing those as a big option, maybe a transition for people who aren't quite there for EVs, just in our last half a minute or so?
Yeah, Toyota is definitely putting some focus on plug-in hybrids, and Toyota's got a new battery under development that they think will give a much larger range. So I would keep an eye on what they're doing with plug-ins.
Mickey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Micheline Maynard, journalist and broadcaster based in Michigan. She's the author of the 2003 book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Now she's got a Substack newsletter. You can find it. It's called Intersection, Everything That Moves. We'll get a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. We talked to her about the state of the auto industry as UAW shops around the country are voting on agreements reached with the three major unionized automakers. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House announced today that Israel agreed to daily four-hour pauses of military operations in Gaza to allow for civilians to leave the area and humanitarian aid to come in. This comes after a week of debate about how to de-escalate the war, with the Biden administration supporting what are called humanitarian pauses. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking at a press conference yesterday.
We had in-depth discussions about the steps that we are taking to address urgent needs on the ground. We all agreed that humanitarian pauses would advance key objectives to protect Palestinian civilians, to increase the sustained flow of humanitarian assistance, to allow our citizens and foreign nationals to exit, and to facilitate the release of hostages. I briefed my colleagues about my conversations with Israeli leaders on pauses and on concrete steps to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians in Gaza and to stop extremist violence in the West Bank.
The Biden administration hasn't pursued a ceasefire, but the United Nations, many world leaders, peace activists, and policy experts are urging that the fighting stop altogether. Our next guest has joined the call for an immediate ceasefire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the Biden administration's support of this idea of humanitarian pauses in the conflict? Do you think the situation calls for a ceasefire? Do you have questions for our guest about what the difference is and about some of the deeper issues underlying the conflict? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. militarism, and U.N. issues. She's the author or editor of 11 books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, and serves as the international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. Phyllis, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Now, first of all, what's your reaction today to this, at least, announcement from the White House about Israel agreeing to temporary humanitarian pauses? I understand we haven't heard a confirmation of that from Israeli leaders.
We have not heard a confirmation, and we haven't seen any halt in the bombing. The humanitarian need on the ground, the urgent need, is to stop the bombing. The idea of a humanitarian pause is better than not having it for, they're talking about 1 or 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. But the reality is that it's not enough. And as soon as that pause ends, the bombing resumes and the killing resumes. So we're now seeing, according to Save the Children, one child is killed by Israeli bombing every 10 minutes. Every 10 minutes. So will this mean that they're only being killed every 11 minutes? If so, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's why we're needing a ceasefire that stops the bombing, period, full stop. And let's be clear, we're talking about a bilateral ceasefire. So that means Hamas also stops sending these rockets of various sorts into Israel. Luckily, none of them are hitting anything. Nobody has been killed by them, luckily. But they are still illegal, so, and they should be stopped as well. But the bombs that are killing people are the Israeli bombs, and they need to stop.
The argument from Israel is that a ceasefire would help Hamas regroup and maybe renew terrorist attacks on Israel itself. What are your thoughts on, first of all, Israeli resistance to the idea of a ceasefire?
You know, this notion that a ceasefire only helps Hamas really sort of begs the question of, what do you think about how much it helps the children of Gaza who might get to live? You know, nobody ever talks about that. It's always, well, will it help Hamas more or will it help Israel more? It's going right to the question of what happens to the fighters, not what happens to the victims, to the people who are doing the dying. That's why we say that there's a need for a ceasefire. That's why the Pope called for a ceasefire. That's why the Secretary General of the United Nations is calling for a ceasefire. That's why governments around the world, not only in the Global South, although clearly more strongly there, today even President Macron in France announced his support for a ceasefire. The U.S. is increasingly isolated on this question. And, you know, we should be clear about this question of what's the role of the U.S. We've been hearing, there was a big piece in the New York Times today, another one in the Washington Post, about how the Biden administration and Biden himself are upset about the lack of Israeli collaboration with what the U.S. is requesting. And I'm sitting there thinking, why should they collaborate? Why should they agree? Because all the U.S. is doing is issuing very polite, mild requests. Please stop bombing. And Netanyahu says, no. And then the answer is, okay, and we'll go on to talk about something else. They're not going to stop the bombing. They're not going to issue a ceasefire. They don't want to, clearly. But part of it is the U.S. is not imposing any consequences for their refusal. So if Biden went to Israel or called him on the phone and said, hey, Bibi, you got to stop the bombing. You got to stop the killing. And Netanyahu said, no. Then the answer is, okay, you're supposed to be an independent country. You can do what you want. But you know the rest of that $4 billion that we send you every year, that some of it's still in the pipeline, the weapons and the cash, you can kiss that goodbye. And you know the other $14 billion we're trying to get Congress to agree to send to you? That's not going to happen. And you know how we've always protected you so that you're never held accountable at the International Criminal Court for the actions that you're taking that violate all kinds of international law, from the Geneva Conventions to the Convention Against Genocide? We're not going to protect you anymore. I think we'd start to see a very different answer from the Israelis very quickly.
Talking to Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies about calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Phyllis, you've written recently about what you hope would come after a ceasefire, and that you say is a look at some of the underlying causes, the long-running causes of these conflicts in the first place. What kind of things would you like to see the U.S. talking about, the international community talking about, and of course, Israelis and Palestinians talking about?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that. It's very difficult to talk these days about root causes, because the idea of talking about root causes is somehow being equated to giving credence or even supporting the horrific acts that Hamas carried out on October 7th, as if understanding why things happen is the same thing as supporting them or something. The reality is, our understanding of history always starts with when you start the clock. If you start the clock on October 7, you see as your first thing these horrific attacks from Hamas against 1,400 people who were killed, about 335 of whom were military. The rest were civilians, mostly Israelis, not all, a lot of internationals as well. And you don't ever get to see why something like that would happen. If you don't understand why it happened, it's almost impossible to imagine what it would take to make it stop, to make sure it never happens again. So if you don't understand that the horrific violence that we saw explode on October 7th didn't, as Secretary General of the UN, Guterres put it, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It was rooted in decades of occupation, 16 years of a brutal siege of Gaza, collective punishment, all kinds of violations of international law and the laws of war. You know, this is now the sixth attack. It's of a whole different scale. It's hugely more punishing, killing far more people and lasting longer than earlier Israeli assaults on Gaza. But those assaults are not new. The first one was in 2008 and 9, what was called Operation Cast Lead. And then there was another in 2012 and another very big one in 2014 that left 2,200 Palestinians dead. There was another one in 2018. And then there was another in 2021, just a couple of years ago. We didn't hear this kind of outrage when Palestinians were attacked with Israeli initiative without any claim that something right then had happened required it. The Israeli position, still until now, as far as I know, but what they always used to talk about at the official level, this is not just some media headline, but in the Knesset, this is called mowing the grass. It was the notion that every couple of years, you have to remind the people of Gaza who's really in control. And you do that by bombing, you do that by imposing an even more crippling siege. You know, one of the things that I hadn't known about the siege of Gaza that began in 2007, it's been a siege now for more than 16 years. And we're hearing now about this brutal siege that has cut off all access to food, water, fuel, electricity, all the things that make life possible in this isolated area. But the siege that's been underway now for 16 years, one of the impacts of it that I had never known, I thought I knew a lot about the impact, the humanitarian impact of the siege, but I didn't know this. It turns out that as of January of this year, way before this current crisis, the siege impact was so bad that 20% of the children of Gaza were stunted before the age of 2, because there simply is not sufficient good food. None of it had protein. They had no access to fresh vegetables, no access to fruit. Often milk was in short supply and baby formula. And the result was 20%, one out of every 5 babies, was stunted in Gaza for the last 16 years. And this is one of those stunning factoids that you never think about until suddenly you do. And you realize how devastating that is for a whole generation of people who are going to grow up in Gaza, those who survive this. We now know from Save the Children that one child is dying every 10 minutes under the bombs. This is the impact of the siege that's been underway since 2007, 16 years. Imagine how many children have now been affected by that.
Bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Appleton. Robert, hi.
Yeah, you know, nobody supports what Hamas did. They went out across the border with the intention of committing horrible atrocities, and they certainly did. However, you also have to acknowledge the reality that one of the reasons why there's this siege that is stunting children is that Hamas has always, since the day they took over in Gaza, said they're committed to the entire destruction of the state of Israel and the death of every Israeli citizen. You also have to keep in mind that Hamas has put legitimate military targets where they will do the absolute most damage to civilians, underneath hospitals, underneath refugee camps. Hamas has fired on Israeli troops that were trying to clear a path to help the people in Gaza to get out to Egypt. And let's be clear, nobody has clean hands in this conflict. Three of the prime ministers of Israel were members of the Irgun gang who carried out atrocities and human rights offenses that are right up there with anything that the Palestinians have ever done. They blew up the King David Hotel full of British soldiers who were there in a hospital.
Robert, thanks for the call, Phyllis.
Robert is absolutely right. And we can look at just a few days ago when the current president of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, called for a holy war against Gaza. And he based it on the biblical story of the Israelites being ordered by God to annihilate the Amaleks for revenge, for vengeance, not for justice, for vengeance. You know, these stories that you can find arguments for whatever you want in the Bible. I guess that's true. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I know a little bit. And I heard about this one, and then I followed up on it to see what he actually said. And yeah, the story of the Amaleks reminded me of our own country, where you had, during what were known as the Indian Wars in the 19th century, many of them, the generals, many of them were ministers. And they were the ones who used the language about killing children. And in one example, in the Sand Creek Massacre, the general ordered his troops to attack a peaceful sleeping village of indigenous people on the banks of a river. And some of his own soldiers came and said, wait, these are children. These are babies and women. And he said, kill them all. Nits make lice. And that became the theme song, the meme, if you will, 200 years ago, of what these wars were about, killing the children because they would grow up to be the people we wanted to get rid of. And this is the same thing we're seeing now. And yes, it goes back to the early founding of the Zionist movement. There's a long history of Zionist terror that was crucial in creating the state of Israel, in expelling the 750,000 Palestinians who were kicked out. And yes, what Hamas is doing, as I said right at the beginning, maybe you missed it, Robert, is that what Hamas did on October 7th was in complete violation of international law, and they should be held accountable. What international law does not allow is two things in this case. One is no one who's carrying out a war, including a war that might be legal, no one is allowed to attack civilians, to issue collective punishment in its war, to refuse to distinguish between civilian and military targets, all of which Israel is doing right now. And on the other hand, what Hamas did also targeted both military and civilian targets. The majority of the people who were killed were indeed civilians. That is also illegal. There is a difference. Both sides are prohibited from attacking civilians, period, full stop.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Phyllis Bennis is with us at the Institute for Policy Studies, looking at the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. She's calling for a ceasefire there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, looking at Israel, Hamas, and Gaza, the Biden administration's Middle East policy, and increasing calls for a ceasefire. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Middleton. Matt, hi.
Hello. Kind of following up on what Rob said previously, I don't think there's going to be any end to this tit for tat until, as Israel said, Hamas is gone. And what does that mean? To me, that means that the entire Gaza Strip is occupied by Israel, the government's replaced, and the Gaza Strip becomes either a province that either is self-governing or has an oversight to it until such time as terrorist organizations aren't being elected by the people. We did the same thing during World War II when Germany was conquered. We replaced the government with one that was drawn up by the Allies. There was a government that was voted on, and there was supervision for the next two or three decades.
Matt, thanks for the call. To clarify, Rob, he was talking about Rob the caller and not Rob the host. Phyllis, your thoughts on Matt's idea there.
Yeah, I suppose that Matt was also a fan of the Iraq War, because that's just what we did there, too. And how'd that go for us? You know, we overthrew the government, dismantled the army, and imposed a government that we thought was going to be democratic. And then we even went through the motions of having democracy. For 20 years, we were at war. I don't think that's going to work. I think that what we need is a ceasefire to stop the violence and then look at the root causes, which have to do with the longstanding occupation and theft of land, which has characterized the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians since 1947-48. I think that what the Biden administration is doing region-wide right now, sending a nuclear-powered and a nuclear-capable, nuclear weapons-capable submarine to the region, sending two aircraft carrier groups with hundreds, it means about 150 warplanes, another 1,000 troops, bringing to a total of 45,000 U.S. troops in the region, special forces that were just sent in. That's not going to reduce regional tensions, which is what we're being told. It's going to ratchet up the regional tensions. That's why we need a ceasefire.
Thanks for the call. Jan joins us now in Wisconsin. Jan, hi. Are you there, Jan? Not hearing Jan, but Jan was wondering about what's going on in the West Bank with a lot of focus on Gaza. There is also violence in the West Bank. What are you watching for there, Phyllis?
Yeah, the level of violence has escalated massively in the last year, and especially in this last month when, as you say, all eyes have been on Gaza. The far-right extremist government that the Israelis elected, we're talking about elections here, that they elected, have, among other things, brought the majority of the Israeli soldiers, including those that had been deployed around the Gaza Strip, to the West Bank to protect settlers while they carry out what amount to pogroms against Palestinian cities and towns and villages. Two more Bedouin villages have just had their whole set of homes destroyed and their villages ended, essentially just wiped out in settler attacks. There was another attack today in Jenin refugee camp that left 10 Palestinians dead. I don't know how many were injured. I just got the news a couple of hours ago. So the level of violence, the olive trees that are being uprooted, Palestinians being arrested in huge numbers. There's now an additional 5,000 Palestinians that have been arrested just this month from the West Bank and are being held almost entirely on the basis of what they call administrative detention in military prisons, where they can be held for 6 months without any charges being filed, without having the right to see their charges, because there are none, with their lawyers having no information about why they're being held. And when the 6 months is up, they can be held for another 6 months. And that can go on, as it is going on in some cases, for years. And of those 1,200 or so administrative detention prisoners, 120 of them are children, because only Israel has a juvenile military detention system. It's the only country in the world that brings children as young as 12. That's when it starts in the West Bank, when you become eligible to be arrested by the military, held and interrogated by the military, imprisoned by the military, and then sentenced by a military judge for a 12-year-old child. Imagine that. So that's what we're looking at right now in the West Bank. And that situation is absolutely explosive. More than 130 Palestinians, that was before the 10 today, so it's now at least 140 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in this last month. So the situation there is very, very dangerous for Palestinians, increasingly so.
Phyllis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project. She's the author of several books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, serves as the international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. She joined us for a look at what's happening in the Israel-Hamas war, including today's announcement that Israel has agreed to humanitarian pauses, that announcement from the White House, why she and others are calling for a ceasefire. You can follow the various conversations we've had about Gaza here on the Ideas Network and NPR coverage over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, answering a listener request, Kate and her guests tackle the issue of problem gambling here in Wisconsin and what help might be out there and available. Join that conversation coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a trend some people are seeing in social media. I have some of this in my own life. People are moving away from some online platforms, Facebook and others, in favor of group texting as their way of doing social online stuff. We're going to talk about that on the show tomorrow. You can get us started right now. Do you have a lot of these text groups on your phone? Maybe family members, a select group of friends, teammates, bandmates, whatever. What do you use those groups for? And did it replace Facebook or another social media site? Let us know. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I have different family groups, a band group, a group of old friends that text during Packer games, probably a few others. Let us know about yours. Then join the conversation tomorrow at 3. This is Central Time.